We were evicted from our home that we grew up in. We had no other home to know of. The bus, we didn't know where it was taking us, but when we did finally get there, it was the Santa Anita racetracks. They had moved the horses out because there were no horse racings during World War II. And so they moved us into the horse barns, the horse stalls. I still smell like the horses because they had just left. We slept in the back where the horses slept.
Meet June Burke.
June Aochi Burke. I was born on October 17, 1932. I am 88 years old.
June spent a good portion of her childhood behind barbed wire in a series of Japanese internment camps in the United States during World War II. June, born in California, English-speaking, and fully American in every way possible, except perhaps to the U.S. government, June was one of 120,000 incarcerated people of Japanese descent, 70% of which were U.S.-born citizens accused of no wrongdoing. June's family lost their home, their livelihood, and to a degree, their family structure. Her brother, also born on U.S. soil, was in the U.S. Army, fighting on behalf of the very government that had imprisoned his family. June not only told me her story, but the stories of others, and one story I found so difficult to believe, I had to confirm it independently. June's story is the story of the struggle that immigrants go through when they embrace a country that doesn't embrace them back. I'm Leslie Gold. This is A Life's Story. So, June, tell me what your childhood was like.
I grew up in a house in Hollywood, California. It was a three-bedroom house. It was a lovely neighborhood. We had Japanese families on both sides of us. I went to Dayton Heights Grammar School, and we had a very simple lifestyle. I have an older brother and an older sister. And my mother and father, we all lived in a three-bedroom house on John Street. My father came from Wakayama, Japan in 1899, and my mother came here in 1924, just before they closed immigration from Japan.
Oh, I didn't realize they closed immigration from Japan in 1924. Why was that?
I guess they had too many Japanese here and they wanted to close the borders. So they wouldn't allow any more people from Japan to come in after 1924.
Okay. Obviously, you, your brother, your sister, you were all U.S. born.
Yes, we were all born in Hollywood, California. My father was 20 years old. He was born in 1879. He came here in 1899 at the age of 20. He came here and said after he makes $1 million, he's going back to Japan. Only he never went back to Japan because he never made $1 million. And my mother came in 1924 as his second wife. He was living in San Francisco during the Great Earthquake. And after that happened, he came down to Los Angeles and he worked as a gardener. He was one of the first gardeners in Los Angeles, and he would just walk up and down Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard and ring on the doorbells and say to them, "I cut your lawn for 50 cents. And they would say, "Okay." So he would cut their lawn, put the leaves, the grass in a burlap bag, and then he would have to walk the lawnmower back to the store where he started from, and grab a wheelbarrow and come back to pick up all the cut grass. No trucks, no cars. And they just walking up and down Sunset Boulevard, ringing doorbells.
Wow.
And cutting lawns for 50 cents. And that's how I believe the gardeners first started in Los Angeles. When they left Japan, I think it was the understanding that they would never go back again. So it marvels me that they were able to leave their father and the mother and know that they'll never see them again. But he wanted to come to America because he heard that the streets were paved with gold, and he was out to come here to find his fortune.
So now tell me, as the country entered World War II, but before Pearl Harbor, as the country entered World War II, and Japan, of course, was part of the Axis, did you notice any shift in attitude towards you, your family, Japanese-American community?
Oh, yes. There was a lot said in the LA Times, Herald Examiner. All of the articles said everything was Japs, Japs.
From the time of their arrival in the United States, Japanese immigrants and other Asian immigrant groups faced systematic discrimination from the American government and the public. That discrimination extended to the children of immigrants, children born in the country, native-born citizens.
And they said, a viper lays an egg. When the egg hatches, it's still a viper. There was all this, the Daughters of the Revolution, the farmers in California had strong prejudices against the Japanese. So going to school, I remember hearing, you dirty Japs, get out of here, go back to Japan. So the first generation could not speak English too well, and they could not read or write English. But we, as growing up as American citizens, we could read what was said in the newspapers and what was being said on the radio, and very strong anti-Japanese feelings.
Help me with this. I don't know what kind of a school you went to. Was it just Japanese Americans? Was it mixed?
It was mixed. We had mostly Caucasian, Japanese, and there was one family, a black family.
So of the friends you had at school, were they also a variety of backgrounds?
Mostly the Japanese children hung out with each other. Like I said, this prejudice was very strong. So I think we just played with Japanese children.
Roosevelt, a Democrat, was in his second term as U.S. president, and he was quite alarmed at the events in Europe during the first few years of World War II. The U.S. had not officially entered the war yet, but Roosevelt leaned into the war by assisting allies and becoming a vital resource and base of support for Great Britain and the other Allied countries. There are some historians that suggest Roosevelt actually wanted to enter the war far before the Pearl Harbor attack, but he was hamstrung by a Congress who was opposed to becoming entangled in a war on foreign soil. However, there's no debate that Roosevelt's sympathy lied with the UK and France. Congress, on the other hand, had passed 5 neutrality acts, and most American citizens also opposed getting involved in the war as well. The U.S. was only 20 years beyond World War I, which cost the country dearly, and U.S. involvement in World War I was considered by many to have been a horrible mistake. The U.S. was not yet the superpower it is today, and there just wasn't an appetite among the public to get into another bloody war. However, Japanese-American loyalty soon became a core issue for Roosevelt's administration.
The FBI were keeping a list of all the Japanese community leaders, priests, Japanese school teachers, martial art teachers. And so when the bombs dropped on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, they were arrested immediately.
Though there was already an established culture of discrimination against Asian immigrants, anti-Japanese sentiment gained momentum after the events of December 7th, 1941. On that day, Imperial Japan attacked a U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, a date which will live in infamy. The attack thrust the U.S. into World War II and set in motion a series of events that would transform the country. The day of and the day after Pearl Harbor, the FBI began arresting Japanese men, many of whom were leaders in their communities, who had been placed on a Department of Justice watch list. Within 48 hours, over 1,000 Japanese men were taken into custody and jailed.
We had a prayer meeting at our home, and we had two priests in our home from the Buddhist church. As we were listening to the broadcast of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there were two men knocking on our door, the FBI, and they came in and they told the priest to get their hats and they took them away.
We have witnessed this morning the district view, a brief severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done. This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours. One of the bombs dropped within 50 feet of KTU Tower. It is no joke, it is a real war.
It was called the Presidential Proclamation, and that allowed the FBI to pick up these men. And some women, some mothers were taken too, because they were Japanese school teachers. The government had been keeping files on these people from the 1930s, way before 1941.
The attack on Pearl Harbor stunned virtually everyone in the U.S. military. American intelligence had known for some time that Japanese was planning an assault, but military leaders had no idea precisely when or where. Hawaii, they assumed, was so far away from Japan that the Japanese Navy could never mount an effective attack. So Japan's carrier-launched bombers found Pearl Harbor totally unprepared.
And then when it came time, when the executive order 9066 was signed in May of 1942, we got a notice on the telephone poles that we were all to be evicted from our homes. They said to be at the bus station on a certain day. For us, it was May 7th, 1942. We had about a week to sell and get rid of everything in our home.
It was actually February 19th, 1942, that President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066. The order did not mention Japanese Americans specifically, nor did it use the term concentration camps. It did, however, claim that the, quote, successful prosecution of the war requires every possible protection against espionage and against sabotage, close quote. And it gave federal authorities the power to remove Japanese Americans from their homes and place them in federal internment camps. 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of which were American citizens, were forced to evacuate their homes and report to assembly centers. June's family had 1 week to sell, liquidate, or discard every possession.
We broke all of our Japanese dishes. We took down all the Japanese photographs and pictures on the walls. My mother tore up every letter that was written in Japanese. She burned all her pictures. And this was not only our family. It was every Japanese family that was doing the same thing, having bonfires in the backyard so that we would not be caught with any Japanese material in our home. We had to have garage sales or yard sales, we called them at the time, and put everything out, and people would come by and maybe give us a dime or quarter or 50 cents for our furniture. And whatever was not sold, we had to just leave.
No one was excused. If you had an ounce of Japanese in your lineage, off to camp you go. It didn't matter if you were elderly, sickly, or even a child like June. Fishermen, farmers, gardeners, shopkeepers, seamstresses, everyone was told to report. They were all deemed to be potential traitors. The U.S. Secretary of War had all Japanese Americans removed from Western states. That included men and women in hospitals, children in orphanages, and even infants who were adopted by white parents. Colonel Carl Benditson, who was the director of Wartime Civil Control Administration, told a priest who ran an orphanage in Los Angeles, "I am determined that if they have one drop of Japanese blood in them, they must go to a camp. It was never really explained how an infant could be a spy for Japan.
We just heard rumors. They didn't know if we were going to be shipped to Japan or whether we were going to be taken someplace. We didn't know what was going to happen to us, how long we were going to be away. And so there were a lot of rumors flying around and, of course, a lot of fear. We were evicted from our home that we grew up in. We had no other home to know of. And so going to camp, the bus, we didn't know where it was taking us. But when we did finally get there, it was the Santa Anita racetracks. They had moved the horses out because there were no horse racings during World War II. So they had closed the Santa Anita racetrack. And so they moved us and moved us into the horse barns, the horse stalls. I still smell like the horses because they had just left. And we slept in the back where the horses slept. And the front part of the barn was, quote, our living room, where my brother and sister slept. And my mother, my father, and I, we slept in the back part of the barn, the horse stall.
You and how many other families were housed in the stables?
Maybe about 10,000.
June and her family spent 6 months living in the horse stalls. Their mattresses were makeshift bags that they filled with hay from the stables. The families showered in open showers where the horses were washed. The women in the camp, who were naturally modest, but forced to shower together, all faced the walls for a modicum of privacy.
June, I'm trying to imagine you go from with a week's notice. Mm-hmm. You and your family goes from a modest but nice mm-hmm. life mm-hmm. to yes. living in stables en masse and yes. showering where horses shower among crowds, basically. Right. What was the overriding feeling of your family and the others in the stables? Was it anger? Was it resignation? Was it something else?
It was resignation at that point. And the feeling that our parents always gave us was you just have to make the best of what was happening.
And make the best of it they did. Japanese Americans acclimated to life behind barbed wire and under armed guard. They were uprooted from their lives, and they found themselves in these strange and sometimes degrading and uncomfortable environments. But they adapted to their new situation, and they adapted admirably and with dignity. They attended new schools. They found inventive ways to pass the time. There was organized sporting events, self-created musical performances, efforts to educate children. They attempted to maintain a sense of normalcy by attending religious meetings and by finding or creating employment within the camp. The Japanese virtue of having a strong will, referred to as gamen, reflects the depth to which resiliency in the face of obstacles is rooted in the culture. There is no self-pity. Just a constructive response to immensely difficult circumstances. Within 6 months, the U.S. government had built a series of camps actually designed for internment. So June and the others were removed from the racetrack and distributed to these camps in rural areas around the country.
They had to keep us there until they built these euphemistically called youth relocation centers, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, inland states, and our family was sent to Rover, Arkansas. So the camps were ready September, October. So we left Santa Anita, and by train, it took us 5 days to get to Arkansas. And as a kid, I'm so excited. I've never been on a train before. And I'm going to cross the Rio Grande River, and I'm going to go through Texas, and I'm going to cross the Mississippi River. And it was so exciting, I thought to myself. I'm going to be see all this. It took us, it seemed like forever to go through Texas. But when we got to Rover, Arkansas, they had made barracks for us, and each family was assigned to a room in a barrack, which was a big improvement from the horse stalls. So it felt like, oh my God, this is wonderful. But we had no access to news or newspapers. So we didn't know what was going on in the outside world. Our whole camp was enclosed with barbed wire, with guard towers, and with soldiers with guns pointed at us down. my sister and her two friends went up to the fence, throwing rocks at the fence, seeing what would happen. And the guard came out, pointed the gun at them, and told them to get away from the fence. And my sister said, she never ran so fast in all her life. She was so frightened.
Aside from the upgrade in accommodations, I use that in quotes, upgrade. Tell me what day-to-day life was like in the internment camp.
You know, 110,000 people lived like this in all the 10 different camps. Pretty much the same. You ate in mess halls. You didn't eat with your family. You ate whenever you wanted to eat. So your family structure was gone, and therefore the father's authority over the family was also gone because he was no longer the breadwinner. In the family structure, it was so strong before the war. Like in a Japanese family, the mother would cook, the father would get fed first because he's the first to sit down. The children would then get to sit down and eat, and the mother was always the last to eat. And in camp, everybody ate whenever they wanted to eat, and you didn't have to eat with your mother and father, so we ate with our friends. The fathers really lost control of their children at that time.
The internees spent their time and energy focusing on situations and events that they had control over. June explained that the Japanese have bred fortitude and resilience into their culture. She told me of a Japanese proverb, which loosely translates into 7 times down, 8 times up. She also told me about the spirit of genbaru, to endure, a trait that is instilled in Japanese children from a very young age. Hi, it's Leslie. I hope you are enjoying this episode of A Life's Story so far. We can do this for you. We'll produce a personal audio documentary for a beloved family member. We will capture their life story and present it in a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that you and your family will treasure for years to come. Details are at the very end of this episode. So the children were going to these schools within the camp, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, from what I've read, the Japanese Americans that were incarcerated at these camps handled the internment industriously. I mean, there were church services, there were nursery schools, there were other schools, there were doctors who were taking precautions so epidemics wouldn't break out. Children had things to do. But what about the fathers that you talk about? What did they do all day?
Yes, my father used to teach what they call kabuki singing, and I used to do kabuki dancing. My mother would grow a lot of plants, like strawberries and flowers, in the yards, in the dirt, whatever she could. And my mother would make slippers and gift boxes left out of leftover material.
Employment at the camps was not mandatory, but most adult internees chose to work. Not only was it a way for them to pass the time and earn a bit of a wage, but also internee employment was necessary for the everyday operations of the camps. The majority work full time, usually around 44 hours a week. At first, the internees were not paid at all for their work. But later that changed, and the rates of pay varied depending on the type of work performed and the skill of the worker. For instance, professional and technical work would earn $16 per month. A mid-range rate was $12 per month for skilled work, and the lowest rate was $8 per month for unskilled work. Not everyone had the same experience, however. June has spent much of her adult life learning of and sharing the stories of her people from this time. She is truly a historian of this chapter of U.S. history.
Fathers were taken away from them. For some families, the mothers were taken away from them and kept in a separate camp.
When did that happen? Or to who did that happen?
At the very beginning of the war, before we were all sent to our camps, they were sent to Department of Justice camps, immigration camps, and kept separate because they were thought to be spies or espousing propaganda and things like that. So they were kept separate. And without counsel, without any legal counsel, they were held without any trial. And there was no reason for the suspicions. There was no underlying reason. My friend, who's 101 years old, they took her father because he had a box of dry noodles. And they said, well, you could light these noodles and wave it to the airplanes in the sky and lead them to airfields or to the airplanes. And it was ridiculous things like that they would say. So we're going to take the box of noodles as evidence and take the father in as a spy.
Well, in retrospect, the policy served no military purpose. It actually harmed the war effort by reducing available manpower and diverting military resources. There was not a single American of Japanese descent, alien or citizen, charged with espionage or sabotage during the war. Not a single one. June's brother volunteered to fight for the U.S. Army during World War II. Now think of that painful irony. He is risking his life and fighting on behalf of the same country that has imprisoned his family. When the Army called for 1,500 volunteers in Hawaii, over 10,000 Japanese Americans showed up, all like June's brother. The Army formed the 442 Regimental Combat Team, which was made up entirely of Japanese American soldiers. And they were a highly effective unit. General Mark Clark of the U.S. Army said the 442 were some of the best fighters in the U.S. Army. He said, if you have more, send them over.
The 100th Battalion were all Hawaiian Japanese Americans. And then the other volunteers, like my brother, volunteered to fight. They were part of what they called the 442 Regiment. And they went to fight in Italy and Germany. And my brother, I think, was involved in liberating the town of Brière, France. So he was one of the lucky ones who came home because he was injured. But the 442 by itself has a history of being the most decorated regiment in the history of the United States Army.
To be clear here, your brother mm-hmm. was fighting on behalf of the U.S.
Yeah.
military yes. while you and the rest of the family were locked up in an internment camp.
Yes. My brother trained in Camp Shelby, Mississippi, which was the next state over from Arkansas. But he could not come and visit my mother before he shipped off. And he wrote me a letter as he was being shipped across the ocean to Europe. And he said, I want you to remember that I'm fighting to prove that we're loyal Americans. And that we don't want to be called Japs anymore. He said, I'm sorry. Tell Mom I'm sorry for the pain I've caused her. But I feel I have to do this. They wanted to prove their loyalty. And they said, we are not Japs. We are Japanese American. And we want to prove our loyalty to the United States.
There is no denying the bravery of the Japanese Americans who served in the 442nd Battalion. They suffered over 800 casualties during World War II. In June of 2000, President Bill Clinton said this at a ceremony honoring the surviving members of that battalion.
When young Japanese American men volunteered enthusiastically, some Americans were puzzled, but those who volunteered knew why. Their own country had dared to question their patriotism, and they would not rest until they had proved their loyalty. As sons set off to war, so many mothers and fathers told them, live if you can, die if you must, but fight always with honor and never ever bring shame on your family or your country. Rarely has a nation been so well served by a people it had so ill-treated.
For the first generation over, your parents, who came from Japan into the country willingly, mm-hmm. and then for their quiet, hard work in this country, got thrown in an internment camp, right? What's the total amount of time you were in the stable plus the camp? 3-4 years, something like that?
Yes, about 4 years altogether.
Okay. In that time, did your parents grow angry at the country?
No.
What would you say their feelings were?
It's remarkable. Our parents had such resilience and such acceptance. And I think they felt that they were not going to be defeated. They had this feeling, I don't know where it comes from, but in Japanese language it's called makenaide. Makenaide. Makenaide means never feel defeated. Never feel defeated. No matter what the circumstances are, you hold your dignity and you hold your peace and you do what is told you have to do. But because you do what you're told you're doing, you are not giving up. You are not giving up as a person who you are. That feeling, I think, was very strong among the Isseis.
June's husband, Marty Burke, not a Japanese American, also marveled at the attitude of those who went through the camps.
What was most remarkable was the resiliency, particularly the mothers and fathers that went to camp. Their ability to adapt, come out of all that with a positive attitude. She didn't have the responsibilities that all the adults had. They lost all their possessions. They lost their property. They lost everything. And for June, it was more of she lost obviously her civil rights, but the fact that she was in camp and she was able to play with other kids and dance and do things like that, which in itself, I think, is a pretty great organizational skills amongst the Japanese in the camps to provide that for the children.
Now, with some time and distance mm-hmm. since World War II, mm-hmm. the actions of relocating Japanese Americans to internment camp is now considered one of the most atrocious violations of civil rights in the U.S.'s short history as a country. Your parents were not angry. What about you? I actually don't, I may be wrong, June, but I don't detect a lot of anger or resentment on your part. Do you have any? Did you ever?
No, I don't think I do. I think if you feel resentment and I think if you feel anger, you're admitting defeat.
And perhaps that's June's superpower, the ability to both endure and later immerse herself in the details of this painful chapter in U.S. history without carrying the pain, without the anger or the resentment that can impair someone's health or their well-being. President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, which began and legalized the process of Japanese internment, was officially rescinded in December of 1944, less than a year before World War II ended. Soon after, the War Relocation Authority began a 6-month resettlement process that released internees into temporary housing.
Coming out of camp, they gave us, each person, $25 and a train ticket to wherever you wanted to go. So our family went to Denver, Colorado, because my father had friends there to sponsor us. So my father worked as a janitor and my mother worked as a part-time cook. And they had to start rebuilding their lives again.
What those thousands of men and women found when they returned, however, was that the lives they left were no longer available to them. Workers lost their jobs during deportation. Families had lost their homes and property to opportunists who seized them in their absence. It would be another 30 years before the men and women who survived internment were offered any formal apology by the United States government, It was 1988. Ronald Reagan apologized to an entire generation of Japanese Americans for unjustly locking them up during World War II. And he admitted it was because of their race and nothing more.
The legislation that I am about to sign provides for a restitution payment to each of the 60,000 survivors, Japanese surviving Japanese Americans of the 120,000 who were relocated or detained. Yet no payment can make up for those lost years. So what is most important in this bill has less to do with property than with honor. For here we admit a wrong. Here we reaffirm our
commitment. Spent a lot of your adult life being involved in the Japanese American history in this country. I know you have been involved with the Japanese American National Museum. Yes. You've been a volunteer at a number of Japanese oriented places like old age homes and so forth. Why do you do that?
I think I felt like I have to give back to my community. I've always wanted to give back.
Marty again on how June became a historian.
The older she got and the more that Japanese became more concerned about what happened, she did too. And she went to work for the Japanese American National Museum. She got involved in a lot of the history as she is now. She's still very, very much involved. It was like an awakening for her, even though she lived through it.
June runs a class called Talk Stories in that retirement home where she volunteers. And she collects the stories that often have been too difficult to tell.
The atom bomb survivors talked about the horror that she saw after the bombing of Hiroshima. She was fortunate not to get injured, but she said she saw her friends, you know, horrible stories of people jumping in the rivers, people's bodies, the skin just falling off of them. Standing there right in front of them, and they would just melt.
Then June told me a story that blew my mind. 2,000 Japanese Peruvians were detained by police and shipped to the U.S. in a little-known prisoner exchange program. At first, I found the details of this difficult to understand.
Also, in this whole process, the American government went down to Lima, Peru, and kidnapped the Japanese families and Peruvians, Japanese Peruvians, and brought them up here. They landed in Louisiana, and their passports were taken away. So now they were in a country with no passport. So they were arrested as illegal immigrants and put in these camps. Yeah, it's crazy. And then when the war ended, these people couldn't go back to Peru because they had no passport. They could stay here in the United States, but they didn't know how to speak English, which they had some burden. But there was a church in San Francisco and here in Los Angeles that provided them shelter and a job. They found jobs for them so that they could migrate here.
Okay, I'm not sure I followed. Wait a minute.
It's crazy.
So it is crazy. It sounds crazy. Japanese citizens were living in Peru.
Right. And some of the Peruvian Japanese were like us. They were born in Peru. They had Japanese parents.
Okay. So they're happily living there. And the United States goes to Peru and takes and grabs those Japanese Peruvians.
Right.
And brings them to the U.S. So we could watch them? Why did we need to get them out of Peru?
For a prisoner exchange program. The United States thought that if there were prisoners of war from the soldiers being captured in prison in Japan, that they would exchange these people for prisoners of wars after the war.
So they were spares just in case we needed them for trade?
Exactly. And then they found they didn't need them anymore. So then they said, okay, you can leave Texas. You can leave Santa Fe. You can leave Texas, but you're on your own. So
Did these people ever get their passports back?
No. So they have no passports to go back to Peru. They have to stay here. But what the government did with a lot of them They were sent to Hiroshima, Japan, and Nagasaki, Japan, to clean up the mess, the atomic bomb mess. That's true. It's true.
Yeah, so that happened. Japanese Peruvians, who had no desire to come to the U.S., were forcibly moved to the U.S. at gunpoint in cooperation with the Peruvian government. Upon arriving in the U.S., their passports were taken, and they were deemed illegal aliens and held at a U.S. prison camp in case the U.S. needed to trade them with the Japanese government for U.S. soldiers and citizens who were captured in Japan during the war. Most of these Japanese Peruvians were not needed for exchange, yet they were stuck in a country that they never wanted to come to, unable to go home to Peru. There's a book on this called The Train to Crystal City, which chronicles this event. June recently learned of an area in California used as an internment camp called Tuna Canyon. The buildings are gone, but June is interested in marking and memorializing the history.
And now there is a builder who wants to build 200 homes on that land. And we are fighting that so that that land could be preserved as a park, as a memorial park for Tuna Canyon. Hmm. So that's where we are now on that.
Is it widely known that that area was a detention camp?
No, it wasn't. I didn't even know about it until I read about it a few years ago in the LA Times.
When I think of June's life, it really demonstrates the benefits of resilience. Resilience helps us develop a protective armor against experiences which could be overwhelming, and it helps us maintain balance in our lives during stressful or difficult periods. It's the ability to, once again, pick ourselves up after trauma or after a painful experience. I think June got an extra dose of resilience. The Japanese culture of resilience was infused into June at a young age, and it has served her well throughout her life. Resilience enabled her to bear grim and distressing circumstances at a very young age with remarkable grace and good humor. After release from the camp, June and her family had to begin again in a new city with no job, no home, no assets of any consequence. Yet begin again they did. And they did so, it seems, without bitterness or self-pity. Resilient people like June view a difficulty as a challenge, not as a paralyzing event. We have both inherent resilience, the natural resilience with which we are born, but we can also develop resilience at any age and learn to activate it at times when we need it most. In each of us, there is a strength and a courage we may not even know we have. I'm Leslie Gold. Thanks for listening to A Life's Story. Hi, it's Leslie. As I create these episodes, I can't help but think of my own parents. They're gone now, and I wish I did this with them. I'd give just about anything to hear them tell their stories in their own voices again. And I thought, well, that's a service worth providing. So now you can get the full life story treatment for your loved one. We capture the life story of an important person in your life, say your parent or grandparent, and create a beautiful piece of audio storytelling that they will love and that you will treasure. You'll be proud to share it with your family, one day your kids and your grandkids. And the personal audio pieces include all the bells and whistles you hear in the podcast episodes. We do in-depth interviews. We score with music, use historical sound. We build a story arc, provide professional narration, and add additional voices. These pieces come out beautifully. And speaking from personal experience, one day you'll be really glad you have it. We are creating personal love stories too. So go to alifesstory.net for more information. alifesstory.net. You can book a call with us from the site and we can discuss who you have in mind for a personal project in a totally no pressure call. alifesstory.net.